Okay, thank you. So actually, I decided that I would give the talk according to Hoodcamp, and apparently I'm not going to talk about what the title meant. So I'm going to talk. So yesterday I motivated, I hope, two problems, and that one is much more technical than the other. I originally intended to talk about the much more technical one, but I decided not to inflict on you the talk I had prepared for the analysts. So and do something more geometric instead. So what I had motivated, I hope, yesterday is that you had a renormalization operator. It takes you from the from a global situation where you have some, so we are studying here a cocycle, so you have a r over z times r2, and you have dynamics that takes x and w to x plus alpha a of x times w, and is a linear matrix r over z to SL to R. And so you have the space of also, so from dynamical system point of view, let's you have the space of all those cosecants, and you want to have some good understanding. And I mentioned that there are some situation well there are some global situation have just a general cocycle. Sometimes you can renormalize, and the system converges through renormalization when you have a priori bounds. One has a priori bounds. Converge to some simple systems. Well, in the situations that I prove, this particular situation, a priori bounds are proved, it converges to some simple system. And then it motivates that you should understand neighborhood of this simple system. So picture is you have some general cos, here's space of all cocycles. Here there's some particular simple system. And once you renormalize, you fall in this neighborhood. So if you can understand everything that happens in this neighborhood, or understand well what happens in this neighborhood, you could conceivably understand what's your original system about. So this, so you are interested in some kind of local theory around the limits of renormalization. And there are two cases that appear distinguished in the situation. So the point that when you renormalize, I said that you get to, so these limits are, that's what I explained last time, are cocycles in SO to R. So cocycles of rotations. So the matrix A is not allowed anymore to take place in this whole non-commutative group, but takes place in subgroup with a compact subgroup. And so then what kind of those limits are? So a cocycle in SO to R, so let's write R theta is equal to cosine 2 pi theta minus sine to the rotation. So sine 2 pi theta cosine 2 pi theta. Right? And So you have this rotation, so you have just a function now that, so a of x is equal to r phi of x for some function phi from r over z to, now it's a function phi from r over z to r over z. Because if you come around the well, rotations, this is a parametrization, but theta is of course defined in modulo 2 pi. Modulo 1. So you have this function. So What you can try is start. Well, you can try to put this in some kind of normal form. So you have phi of x. You can try to conjugate it. So you start conjugation among cocycles of rotation. So you can try to understand. So conjugation equation is this one. A of x, b of x minus 1. So if you have a of x is a the matrix that depends, and then you generate a new matrix in this format, a prime of x, then dynamics of a of x and a prime of x is the same, because of course you get this general formula for iteration. So you get this. So your iteration, so you can, may want to conjugate. So if you have just a cocycle of rotation, just a function, you see, you try to conjugate it by other rotations. So you try to write this equation, r psi x plus alpha, r phi of x, r psi of x minus 1. So do this with assuming that A and B are rotations. And you come to the cohomological equation, plus phi, well, not cohomological equation, but you get this. Psi of minus psi of x, and you can try to see what are the, so you can, you are allowed to do this operation, can add some kind of co-boundary, and you can see what kind of things you can get. And then typically when you try to, you could try to find simplest models with this. So typically you can get often, let us say, if phi is homotopic to other identity, then you can conjugate to constant. So you can try to solve, you can often conjugate to constant so that you can get this to something that doesn't depend on x. You can choose psi in a way that doesn't depend on x often. And then this is what you get. So you can you get cocycles of constant. So this is just to solve this equation. Here it's so homotopic to a constant means, it will mean exactly that phi takes values in R. Actually, it admits a lift to R, this function. So this is the case of homotopic identity. So here you just look at the Fourier series of phi and you try to solve the coefficients. There will be some small divisors, but let's not worry about this at the moment. So you can try to get close to constant. So that's what you should do in the case of homotopic identity, which turns out to be more complicated to make the local analysis than the other case. So the other case is you cannot lift to R. So you can only get close to something that is still, once you conjugate, you still get something that's not homotopic to identity. So the correct systems that you should try to conjugate to is exactly systems of the form R. So A of X equals R, let's say, DX, right? So RDX, so this gives something that's turning. So this is a function well-defined from R over Z to, so phi of x equals dx is a function on the circle, from the circle to the circle, it's a decovery, but it doesn't lead to, you cannot take values, you cannot solve the... So anyway, so this is the model. So you have two models. So for the homotopic identity, you have a model that's just constant, and for the non-homotopic identity, you have models like this. So you have a you are rotating with x, and but the rotating matrix always in the same direction and turns until it gives an integer number of turns. So what I had intended originally was to explain how's the neighborhood of how you treat the neighborhood of constants. But what I decided to do today is to explain how to treat a neighborhood of this, because this is much more geometric and simple. So here there'll be no computations, essentially. So much simpler to follow. So what I said is that we discovered that there is a class of cocycles that are, of matrix that are a neighborhood of this. So this matrix is just, if you look at the image of a line like this, so it's just XW, you look at the line dot W for some constant W, look at this, and then it just starts, it just rotates D times. It's going to wrap around D times like this. So that's the image of a line if you look at the projective value. So you look at the action R over Z times the projective, you projectivize the R2, and then this gives a second circle, so that if you look at the phase space, it's a two torus, that you can work in this two torus. And that's the image of a line that's of this type, so constant in the second coordinate. I projectivize at R2, so I get a circle once I projectivize R2. So projectivize means that I look at all the lines that are passing through the origin, so that gets so so I look at this. So then the class of cocycles that I'll also be understood by geometrically is the class of, so the class that I'm going to study is class of monotonic cycles, which so this terminology introduced by, so this is joint work with Rafael Krikorian. The other part would be joint work with Svetlana Shtomirskaya, that I'm not going to talk about. But so this is a, so this class of monotonic cocycles, it's the class of cocycles of matrix, so we have those matrices A of X, such that the image of a line that's horizontal like this turns out to be to be have some kind of inclination. So what I don't want to happen is this thing here. So now it's not anymore just a straight, it's going to be a curved. So this I don't want. I don't want then to have some tangents with horizontal foliation. So this is not allowed. So this is not allowed. What I want is something like this. I have a horizontal foliation, and I have an image of line of horizontal foliation, and it looks like it may be a little bit curved, but not enough to create some tangents with this horizontal foliation. Well, maybe maybe something like yeah. So here's degree one picture. So you don't, I want more or less this this situation. Okay. So you see that it's just a geometric condition. So you're going to look that the class is a C1 neighborhood of those guys. The C1 open set containing those guys. Some quite decent condition. You can vary quite a bit, so you don't need to control further derivatives. It's quite strict condition, so it's easily checked that you are in this situation. And certainly, if you renormalize fast enough, if you renormalize enough, you're going to fall in this neighborhood. Yeah, so this not zero. So, of course, under this condition, you cannot have, so exactly, it's a nice geometric condition, but it interdicts the case where it is a homotopic to the identity. Because in the case of homotopic to the identity, you must have something like this. You can maybe start growing up, but at some point you have to go back. So total number of turns has to be zero. So in the end, you have to have some tangents at some point. Yeah, so it's identity maps. A of X equals I. Yeah. So, yeah. So you have on top to a constant, so degree zero. So that's degree zero and higher degree. So degree zero is you have to have some picture like this, and you are forced to have tangences. And in higher degree, it's allowed to not. So it cannot say anything about the case of homotopic to constant. So I'm going to talk about a higher degree. So this is an integer, so this is not zero for us. This would be d equals zero, which is not interesting for us, well, today. And so what's the special about this? So I just have a geometric condition. What can I conclude from this geometric condition? So what happens is that it has a consequence for complexification of this. So you can now complexify the system, and you are going to be interested. I'm going for the moment to assume that A of X is analytic. So A is analytic. So you have your circle, R over Z. So here's your circle. And then I'm looking to, my A is defined for small values of, I can look at the matrix AX plus epsilon I. So I look at a circle, but slightly with slight positive imaginary part now. Okay, so this is a drawing C over Z. Huh? So anyway, So this now, if you look at this matrix, now it's going to be a matrix in SL2C. Okay. So because it had determinant 1, it's going to have determinant 1, and then, well, but coordinates can become complex. Now, now what's special about this matrix and how this condition gets in is the following. So you're looking, now projectivization of R2, now it's going to, you're going to need to replace it by projectivization of complex of C2. So now pairs PC2, which is, well, which contains PR2. And there are many models for this. So usually for this situation, so you can think that PR2, is, so PC2 is going to be just the Riemann sphere, right? And this is the line, this usual projectivization here that you get. So here on this, SL2R acts by maybe acts like this. So A, B, well, SL2C acts on a point in overlines in on the Riemann sphere by like this, AZ plus B. So in those coordinates that again. So, so I have this. And what's my condition here? It's more or less the following. Ah, there is already something written here. So, I want to see where the upper half line is going by this picture. So I have here the line, R, and I'm interested in the upper half line. And now I have matrix A of X plus epsilon I, and I want to see the image of the upper half line by this matrix. Now, what happens that if I look at A of X plus epsilon, so if I look at a point Z, let's look at the boundary. So you can look at the boundary of the upper half plane. So it's the line. So I look at Z, let's say in R. Forget infinity for the moment. So I look at Z in R, and well, X in R. Look at vector Y in R. And I am interested in looking A of X plus epsilon I times Y. Where is it going to go? So I note that what my condition is about the real behavior. So what I know is about A of X plus epsilon times Y. So I know that once I change a little bit my point X, it puts, so I have the picture with those without tangents here. So my Y, I'm looking at the line here. So this is, you mentioned that I'm fixing value of Y, and I'm now varying X. So I'm looking at the image of this. And now I'm going to, once I go from X to X plus epsilon, I see that my Y had to move. So it had to move to the right, let us say, once I change my epsilon in the real direction. So I change X to X plus epsilon, and the image of Y moved, always in the same direction. So what's going to happen here when I add X plus epsilon I times Y is by Cauchy-Riemann equations, I was forced, before I was moving in this direction, I had a vector point in here, I'm going to have a vector point up. No, it's going to be turned by I. So what happens that the image of my point Y, by a little, once I add a little complex imaginary part, now it goes always, all of them goes up. They always go in the same direction. If I had some kind of a different direction, it was not monotonic, some points would go up and some points would go down, and this would be there would be no better control than that. But now everybody goes up together. And at infinity, you're going to see that they go down, but you just by change of coordinates, so not important. So important thing is that image of this is going to go inside itself and compactly. Well, maybe like this. So what happens is that I have this upper half line, and as soon as I add a little bit, before it was completely invariant, before, because I had SL2R matrix, the preserved the upper half line, now I add a little bit of imaginary part, and it goes strictly inside itself. Now, what happens here is that this is a cone field for my dynamics now. So that is something that's being contracted. So what happens that once I'm inside this upper half plane, I continue iterating, and my points are going to converge. So now I'm going to look at iterates of this. I'm going to iterate this many times, and I'm going to start conversion. I'll have some hyperbolic dynamics. I have some invariant cone field, and then this gives a hyperbolic dynamic. So then what happens that dynamics at imaginary z equals epsilon I is hyperbolic. You're going to have a continuously, or in this case, analytically dependent, unstable and stable manifolds. And the unstable manifold will be in the upper half plane, and the stable manifold will be in the lower half plane. Because, of course. So that's the good thing about those systems. So those systems are not uniformly hyperbolic, those systems here. So never. So the systems like this, they cannot be uniformly hyperbolic for the following reason. If I had an unstable direction, so let me write this because I don't write much. So a cocycle of degree non-homotopic to constant is never uniformly hyperbolic. So why is it? Because if it was uniformly hyperbolic, there would be some unstable direction, and there would be, well, and also the stable direction. But let's look at the unstable direction. They are continuously depending direction in the projective line, in the projectivization of the of R2. Now, once I apply my cocycle, it's lifting things. It has some degree. So you look at this curve. So let's see that I had maybe a candidate for being my my unstable direction. So let's say that's something like this. It can be have a positive degree or whatever. So I have my candidate for unstable direction, and it is invariant. But once I apply once my cocycle, the degree of this section of this invariant unstable direction changes. But it has to be the same section still. So this gives contradiction. So the cocycle is picking any curve and changing its degree once you apply once. So so this interdicts the existence of invariant section. And then it interdicts the uniform hyperbolic. So those kind of systems are never uniform hyperbolic. However, if you allow complexification, you see that they are immediately at the boundary of uniform hyperbolic complex cocycles. So that's why it's important to consider. So you can never get to any uniform hyperbolic system by making a small a real perturbation. But as soon as you make this complex perturbation here, you are already uniform hyperbolic. So the point will be to understand the dynamics of that is hyperbolic, so it's more or less clear what happens, but make the estimates of what happens now when epsilon goes to zero. So now you estimate what happens to epsilon goes to zero and see what from the uniform hyperbolicity you keep. Okay. So let me say let me give some theorems. Is just an introduction, we can erase. So, so then I'm going to discuss a little bit how to actually get there. But let me say something that we can prove the theorem. So I'm assuming for the moment that I'm in the space U of, so I fix A alpha, let us say. And they consider the space U of analytic monotonic So I'm going to I try to understand this big open set of cocycles. So theorem is that first, Lyapunov exponent is analytic function of A. So you consider, let's say, a one parameter analytic family of A's, then the dependence of the Lyapunov exponent to be analytic on the parameter. So this is one thing. Another thing that it's proven, it's a rigidity theorem. So assume that your interest mostly in the case of Lyapunov exponent is zero after all, right? So assume that L alpha A is equal to zero. It's real analytics, real cocycles. So assume that Lyapunov exponent is zero. So after all, the original motivation is to study those guys. Now, what can I say about it? Originally, in general, in the most of the constants, I cannot say much. In this case of monotonic cocycles, I can say a lot. This implies that A is, the cocycle alpha A is analytically conjugate to a cocycle with values in SO2R, so a cocycle of rotations. So what's happening here is that I have this non-commutative group SO2R, or my cocycle lived, and under this condition of zero Lyapunov exponent, I get rid of all the non-commutative part and fall in this commutative. There is still some problems that appear. So I still cannot say that my cocycle is going to be conjugate to some kind of normal form. There, because here, look, that I no assumption on arithmetic properties of alpha. So just pick your irrational number which may be extremely Liouville. And I'm saying that at least if the Lyapunov exponent is zero, it's monotonic cocycle. If the Lyapunov exponent is zero, then it is because your cocycle is actually commutative. It's taking value in some commutative group. But this is, if you want to actually solve, there will be still some commutative problems. There's cohomological equation with small divisors that you may be unable to solve. So you cannot put in some normal form in the end. But a big part of it is solved. It's not because of the non-commutative part, it's just because there's cohomological equation to be solved at some point. So this is a rigidity theorem. And I'm going to mention a third one that's most interest, well, for people, maybe Christian gave some motivation to talk on Monday, but it's actually difficult to prove a minimality, to understand something about the topological dynamics. I want to say something about the topological dynamics of this cocycle. So I have this dynamics in the story, and what I can prove is that alpha A acts minimally, is minimal on R over Z times PR2. So it doesn't look to have much to do with the previous theorems. It's actually difficult to prove in general the minimality for this kind of systems. What's mostly interesting maybe for you would be that the proof of this topological statement is based on it's purely complex analysis. So you don't look much at the dynamics. It's proofs completely by exploring properties of analytic functions. So this kind of theorems can be proved by this with this method. Let me mention that in the case of homotopic identity, nothing of this can be expected to hold so nicely. So in general, Lyapunov exponent is not smooth function in the case of Schrödinger case. It's not going to, certainly not going to be analytic. So typically, it's going to be zero in a counter set, and then positive in a otherwise. So often it happens like this. So of course, cannot be analytic. Cannot be C1 also. It's best regularity that can be expected in general is something like Hölder, in the case of Schrödinger. So here you can get much more. So interesting situation, quite unexpected when we started doing it. We would never expect it because what's happening here, for instance, that Lyapunov exponent, what's Lyapunov exponent? It's something that depends on the expansion on the unstable direction. Here's a non-uniform hyperbolic system. Everything, the unstable direction, etc., is depending purely measurably. So it's a measurable function that you are integrating the expansion along. And what happens that even if everything's measurable, it turns out that the Lyapunov exponent is still, the average expansion still depends analytically. So a priori, there's no reason to expect this to start with. It's not in a uniform hyperbolic regime, but some characteristic of the system that survives from the previous situation. So let me now mention one aspect. Let me give more theorems before going maybe a little bit in proofs. So it looks that it's extremely important to have analyticity at this point, right? Because my whole business started by doing Cauchy-Riemann equation at this point and saying that I got in the boundary of cosacs and I used the analytic extension of the function. It turns out that's not important. Well, of course, to get analytic here, for instance, it should be important, but an analytic here. But to get most of this, if you subtract a little bit of smoothness, it is actually not important. So what happens that I took an idea from a paper of Misha on where he discussed smooth one-dimensional dynamics and proposed that a smooth one-dimensional dynamics can be quite analyzed by similar methods as analytic by doing some trick. So you don't have to do a similar trick. It's actually simpler than what he considers, but we are interested actually in computing very precisely what's going on. So make lots of estimates. So the idea is to make almost holomorphic, so extension to smooth version. Extension to smooth setting. So what you consider is that you in this case, you don't have analytic extension. There's nothing canonical. You just have A of X. So you can define extension A of Z to a strip, let's say, to strip. So you around your circle. So here, so circle's here, and I define it something here. You can make global extension, but not important. So A of Z to strip with almost holomorphic. It's almost holomorphic, or asymptotically. I think maybe the best is asymptotically holomorphic. So essentially, you are going to say that it's still going to have a derivative, a complex derivative at the real line. And you look at the mistake to become actually completely holomorphic, and you look at the first order, it's going to be okay. In second order, it's going to be okay. In third order, and so on. And you can do this, depends on the smoothness. If you have a same infinity, it can be asymptotic to all orders. You can, or arbitrarily high order. If you are in C10, you're going to be able to take care of 8 or 9 orders. So it's going to be quite reasonable. So from this, considering those asymptotic extensions, you can make the estimates. It's still, Cauchy-Riemann equation still works here because to first order it's right. So you're still going to have the hyperbolicity in the, so part, this part of the argument goes. What's going to be able to, you're going to need to work more is that you're not going to be able to use the standard arguments in complex analysis to look at the limits. So you're going to have to make more computations in the end, but it can be done. And then you can compute exactly how much regularity you're going to lose and so on. So it's true still that if I put smooth here, let's say C infinity, so what kind of theorem would be true is that if I put here C infinity, and then the Lyapunov exponent C infinity function of A, and Lyapunov cocycle is C infinity conjugate. And I can go quite low in the regularity also. So that, maybe it's not, I forgot certainly, because it's computed in the paper. Huh? Well, in CR, I'm going to lose like 1 plus epsilon, maybe half of the. Doesn't depend on actual Diophantine condition. There is a little bit of loss because, but I don't see it like this. So we cannot. And here there's a statement that doesn't have any regularity involved, and here you don't lose anything. So for this statement, I don't remember if I need C2 plus epsilon or C1 plus epsilon to get this statement. I don't remember. It's for minimality statement. For the others, you lose, I think here you lose half of the derivatives, and here you lose 1 plus epsilon, probably. This. Okay, so there is this possibility. So analyticity is actually, you can say something even about smooth co-cycles, and actually another feature is that you can also differentiate on alpha. You can change the base dynamics. In this statement, you can see initial function of alpha and A for this statement. It's not true in the analytic category that you can get analyticity on alpha, but it's true in the smooth category. Okay, so there it is. Let us see now one of those theorems to see how it is proof is simple. Maybe the most curious is proof of minimality, which I don't remember very well, so it's probably going to go slowly. Let us see if I get the proof. So what was actually what happened to prove minimality? That I was not trying to prove. I was trying to prove something else. Yes. Well, since you have positive Lyapunov exponent, you have two invariant measures, the unstable invariant measure and the stable invariant measure, when the Lyapunov exponent is positive. If it's zero Lyapunov exponent, it's going to be uniquely ergodic. It's going to be like skew shift. But in other case, you always have, so this is simple. So you have exactly two invariant ergodic invariant measures, the unstable one, the stable one. So that, one integral gives positive Lyapunov exponent, and other integral gives negative Lyapunov exponent. So it's not not very good. So one more thing that I can compute more or less a lot of things. So this locus here, where your conjugate to SO2R, is some kind of variety. So it's a small, so differently from homotopic constant case, where you have some kind of positive measure of zero Lyapunov exponent. Here, this is some kind of a variety of positive codimension. So this, you just check the derivative. Well, in the analytic case, more or less obvious because it's just some equation that you're solving for some analytic function. In general, you can actually compute more or less the codimension because you can compute the derivative, some derivatives of this. Well, more or less, as some kind of Laplacian. But, this situation's here now. In this situation, it's completely different from constant. So there, here the Lyapunov exponent is automatically positive without much hope to avoid. Okay. That being said, let's study. The minimality problem because the curious. So as I say, is that it was not originally intended to be proved. We're not looking for it. What happens is that I proved the curious contradiction in math during my analysis. So I was trying to prove something else, and then I proved something so good that I could not be true, right? So then I checked why is it failing, and I understood that actually we're proving this. So what was the thing that was going so well that it was the following. So you have this unstable direction. So what you have to prove, so you have this unique ergodicity. So it was pointed out. Ignore the zero Lyapunov exponent. If Lyapunov exponent is zero, it's conjugate to SO2R over cycle, make the computation sheet that's minimal. There's nothing to do in this case. Now, in the case of post Lyapunov exponent, you're going to have the two invariant, so that's a unique minimal set. So this was mentioned by Christian in his talk. So you have a unique minimal set. Which the closure of the essential support of unstable manifolds. So you have positive Lyapunov exponent, you have unstable direction, you have stable direction. It's closure of the unstable direction. And it's also the closure of the stable direction. So it's what happens that if just uniquely ergodic, then of course, uniformly hyperbolic, then they have two directions. They are separated. In the case that they are non-uniformly hyperbolic, because they touch somehow, and this means that their closure is actually the same. And this can be shown that this is a unique minimal set. So this is so credits to Ehrman with idea of Johnson by Christian. So you have this unique. So you want to understand the closure of unstable direction, for instance. So what's happening here is that when you complexify, you have the unstable direction here. It's just a nice curve lying the upper half plane. So you have a nice function, let's say that when for z in this trip, so you have a original and understood interested on the image in this real line. But now let's look at z slightly up, where my dynamics is going to be uniformly hyperbolic. So for z in the upper half plane, I'm going to have some unstable direction u of z that belongs to upper half plane. I come back to an analytic setting because I don't want to do the smoothness business. So I have my u of z is an analytic function. So my unstable direction is depending perfectly analytically on everything here above. Now, I have this analytic function, and what I'm looking is just the extension to the boundary. I want to know if this extension to the boundary is filling everything or not. Now, here's where I made my mistake. I said I have this analytic function, and it takes place in the upper half plane. Once I go to the boundary, it takes real values because unstable direction almost every, so it's measurable, but almost everywhere it becomes real valued. Because why does it become real valued? Because unstable direction exists. It's hyperbolic, Lyapunov exponent is possible. So that is what you have. So what happens, I have this function, and I know that u of so the limit at real points, so this limit at non-tangential limit almost everywhere is actually in R or union infinity or something. In our area. And I said, oh, well, now we want to very much to apply Schwarz reflection principle to say that, well, I have a function that takes values here and then takes real values. I want to say that you can make it holomorphic function by reflecting around this. So that's my intention. And I said, well, there are some conditions in this theorem, but I didn't have any book available. So I tried to think, well, maybe usually they say that the function has to be, let's say, continuous in the bound. It doesn't look very important. You do some convolutions and so on. So it should not be a problem. Well, this convolution business is good function bounded also. Otherwise, it doesn't work. But then I somehow convinced myself that a real line is the same as a circle, and a circle, everything is bounded. So it's also going to work. So that was what I thought. And my conclusion was very interesting, that since this extends analytically through the line, I get some analytic function on the real line. That's my unstable direction. So conclusion is that u of x is analytic function. So I discovered that the unstable direction is actually continuous dependent, even analytically depending on a parameter. So actually my system was uniformly hyperbolic, because we have this continuity of the unstable direction, which was very unsettling. So what's wrong with proof is except that this key point there, the business about measurability is not very important. Can do the convolution, it's okay. But to do the convolution, the boundary is very important. It's not allowed to do this business with the circle. So what happens that you cannot get rid of, so for this not to work, you cannot get rid of infinity. So it's really going to bother you to create some unboundedness on this. So it means that your unstable direction is visiting around infinity. It has to be, otherwise you could trick it. And also this argument has to be it has to be creating problems everywhere, because otherwise I could make local analytic extension and then extend it by iteration finitely many times. So everywhere infinity is causing problems. So what I conclude is that my minimal set is seeing infinity all the time. So conclusions that infinity, so R over Z times infinity is contained on the minimal set. It has to be contained, because if I have some little open set where infinity is not there, I can get analytic extension through that little window, and then I extend everywhere in this contradiction. Now, the point is that nothing important about infinity. I am allowed to make make some kind of conformal change and put infinity everywhere, to make any point become infinity. So conclusion that any point here can play the role of infinity in this construction. So conclusion that the whole PR2 is actually contained in this minimal set. And that's minimality. So unstable direction has to visit everything. I hope it was more or less clear. There's a lot to ask questions. So So that's whole proof. So it's essentially that what's preventing my, I know that I cannot be uniformly hyperbolic, and the only thing that prevents Schwarz lemma to be working is that infinity is bothering me all the time. It's bothering means that it appears in the business. So, so since it's such a nice lemma, previously, maybe my previous talk I went I speak for a full hour, I maybe stop now already. Well, so once you are in upstairs, it is analytic. So dependent on, so you can look at the function, you can consider as a function of epsilon. A epsilon is just A of x, A of epsilon of x is just A of x plus I epsilon, or epsilon I. So I can consider any epsilon Lyapunov exponent, which is going to be just a Lyapunov exponent, I do this formula. So L epsilon is clearly analytic function, function of A. Okay? So L epsilon of A. L epsilon of A is equal to L of A epsilon. So you get this analytic function of A. So, of course, now why it should, so in principle doesn't help at all, but now this analytic function, there's another parameter that I can consider. I can vary x. I can add some x direction. So I can consider L epsilon. So so you can consider maybe LZ of A, where it's going to be plus Z, more general. Now I sham some, not with some cost imaginary part. So Z with some, Z is equal to x, let's say some real number plus a small imaginary part. So this also is still analytic function, and it's going to be harmonic on Z, because it's something that appears with Lyapunov exponent, appears as harmonic function. Harmonic on Z, and doesn't depend on A, because the Lyapunov exponent integrates on A, does not depend on A. So it must be affine on epsilon. So you see that there's a relation that says that L of A is equal to L epsilon of A, which is analytic function, minus some something that depends on epsilon, minus some affine function of epsilon, which doesn't depend actually on the construct. This is something like the degree. So here, this gives an analytic formula for the Lyapunov exponent.